From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Francisco.
Vallejo?
I'm from Redwood City, so I guess that's in the peninsula.
Coming up, we continue our series on the Bay Area's most impoverished neighborhoods.
I was born and raised here, and my perception goes back 48 years in this community. I think we've gone through a lot of change. We've gone through a lot of trauma. I think we're in a tipping point right now.
In San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point, we'll meet the people building community at the YMCA.
It is said that it takes a village to raise a child. We believe that it takes a family to create the village.
And we'll learn why the state is eliminating its youth prison system.
Because violence is a byproduct of hurt people hurting people. And so what we need to do is, in a real way, invest in those communities.
That's today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood has higher rates of poverty, unemployment, and violence than any other part of the city. But its relative geographical isolation, it's cut off by the 101 and 280 freeways, can make those issues all but invisible to residents of other neighborhoods. For decades, it was a bustling neighborhood, one of the only majority African-American neighborhoods in the city. During World War II, the booming naval shipyard drew thousands of black families, mostly from the South, with the promise of well-paying work, and they thrived. By the 1960s, though, years of racial discrimination and rising unemployment were beginning to take their toll on black families throughout San Francisco. Redevelopment in the Fillmore pushed many African-Americans out of the center of the city and into Bayview Hunters Point. At the same time, work at the shipyard was slowing down. The Navy shut down the shipyard altogether in 1974, causing more unemployment and more poverty. Since then, persistent toxic waste and limited access to fresh food have led to disproportionately high rates of asthma, diabetes, and cancer. The epidemic of crack cocaine in the 80s and 90s devastated many families. Today, Bayview Hunters Point is still dealing with the aftermath of its troubled history, but the area is pulling together in many ways. In this next installment of our series in the Bay Area's five poorest neighborhoods, KALW's Jen Sheehan visits the Bayview Hunters Point YMCA, where people are working to rebuild their community, one family at a time.
The Bayview Hunters Point YMCA is housed in an imposing three-story building at Lane and Revere Street, a few blocks off of busy 3rd Street in southeast San Francisco. The front door and lobby were recently renovated with lots of glass and open space. It gives me a warm, welcoming feel as I walk in. Blonde wood floors gleam in a shaft of sunlight. There's an old-fashioned popcorn machine in a corner and artwork on the walls. To one side, I hear the sounds of a girls' basketball game. Down another hall, a piano. Some kids bust out from the doors to the stairwell, giggling, and then suddenly quiet. The moment evokes a time when this building housed the All Hallows Catholic School, which the Y's executive director, Gina Frommer, graduated from in 1977.
I was born and raised here, and my perception goes back 48 years in this community. I think we've gone through a lot of change. We've gone through a lot of trauma. I think we're in a tipping point right now.
The YMCA took over the building in 2001, and Frommer became executive director in 2006, excited to give back to the community where she was raised. When she arrived, Frommer surveyed residents about their priorities for the area. Personally, she thought strong families were crucial, and she found her neighbors felt the same way.
They felt that if families were strong, we wouldn't have truancy in our community. If families were strong, our streets wouldn't look the way they did. And the way you strengthen families is strengthen the children.
This is a key point. Children make up close to a third of the neighborhood's population, compared with under 15% in the city as a whole. And the programs at the Y have been built around this family-strengthening goal. As Associate Executive Director Neil Hatton puts it,
so we're not just a typical swimming gym.
The Y fills its three floors from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. with programs ranging from social services to Zumba. Kids can participate in after-school activities like nutrition workshops, street art classes, or a mock government club. There's a school district teacher and a counselor on site.
Anyone have any questions?
The Y collaborates with the school district on an anti-truancy program called the Center for Academic Reentry and Empowerment, or CARE. I meet Eason Ramson, the director of CARE, in the hallway on the 3rd floor. It still looks like a school up here, with lockers lining both walls. But the program offers something quite different.
A lot of kids have been truant out of school for as long as a couple years. They might be 15, 16 years old, but they can only read it at fourth or fifth grade level, and they're embarrassed to go back to school because they can't keep up. So we meet them where they are, and we engage them there, and we work with them to bring them up to speed.
19-year-old Devon Burrows says it was hard for him to focus in school because he had troubles at home. He was able to get his high school diploma through the WISE programs.
You got people that help you on a one-on-one basis, and you got people that can help you like in a class setting. So it's like you got almost have choices, a choice of which way you could learn and which is best for you.
From the classroom, it's only a few steps across the hall to the Family Resource Center, where needs from food assistance to counseling can be addressed. Jim Martin directs the Fatherhood and Men's Services Program.
Whatever it takes to help keep a family whole, because we believe here that, it is said that it takes a village to raise a child. We believe that it takes a family to create the village.
Martin grew up in Hunters Point and believes it's important for people like himself to remain in the community as role models for youth. As a youngster in the 60s, he participated in a Hunters Point community program that showed kids different career options.
We got to see other functional people as children working in jobs that we had not had exposure to before.
Although Martin's experience was decades ago, kids in Bayview Hunters Point still have trouble today finding safe, productive, enriching activities in their own neighborhood. That's why the after-school programs at the Y are so important. I visit the teen center on the second floor where two kids, Ian Smith Jr. and Aaliyah Anderson, are playing pool. Smith is 17 and has been coming here for about 2 years.
I do my homework here. I do a music class, and we're about to start up a graffiti class.
16-year-old Anderson is also a regular.
I come here when I get out of school. I love it coming here because it's better here than on the street like other people.
Teen Services Director Jasmine Benton also grew up in the neighborhood. In fact, she went to after-school programs in this very building when it was still a school.
I used to do pottery here on the very bottom first floor.
Benton is like many, if not most, of the staff I meet at the Y, born and raised right here in Bayview Hunters Point. Benton believes this is one of the reasons the WISE programs are so effective.
Especially dealing with youth, they feel like you're more real because you're not coming in and like saying, well, this is how I see things and this is what I've heard. It's more so like, I experienced this with you. You know, so let's take this, you know, road together.
Every Thursday, the Y has a free public day of fitness. Community members can attend workshops, enjoy open gym time, or play basketball. The day of fitness ends with evening Zumba, a high-energy exercise class based on Latin dance. The class at the Y regularly draws around 100 people, from teens to adults, even some seniors. It takes place in the gym. The night of my visit, a boys' basketball game is in full swing right up until the start of the class. Ladies, and some gentlemen, arrive in a steady stream, dressed in colorful workout gear. They sign in at the front desk and line up in the hallway outside the gym doors, buzzing and chatting.
1 second!
The second the game ends, the Zumba hordes begin streaming into the gym before the boys have cleared the court or even retrieved all the balls. Though the Bayview Hunters Point YMCA is bustling now, there are still more plans in the works. Fundraising is in progress for a new preschool, an expanded teen center, and a commercial kitchen for entrepreneurship training.
The change is in front of us right now. The opportunity is in front of us.
Executive Director Gina Fromer.
But ultimately, it's not the outside that's going to heal us. It's the people who live here are going to say, no more, we're moving forward, and we're going to take advantage of these beautiful places like the Y and, you know, the storefronts, and this is our community, and we deserve to have a beautiful, viable community.
In Bayview Hunters Point, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
This is the third in our series of stories about the Bay Area's most impoverished neighborhoods. You can find the first two on Alameda Point in downtown Berkeley on our website. It's kalw.org. Next week, we'll be visiting West Oakland. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Community centers like the YMCA and Bayview Hunters Point work to create alternatives for young people who might otherwise turn to crime. And the hard work these rec centers have been putting in might be paying off. Juvenile crime in California has been steadily declining for several decades, reaching an all-time low in 2010. What hasn't changed much, however, is the disproportionate number of youth of color who are being incarcerated. This is the focus of organizations like the W. Hayward Burns Institute. The San Francisco-based nonprofit has been working for years to help counties remake their juvenile justice systems so they're equitable. It's going to become more and more important as California begins to phase out its statewide youth prison system in favor of county alternatives. It's a controversial proposal from Governor Jerry Brown and one that's likely to be implemented by 2014. KALW News Director Holly Kernan sat down with Burns Institute founder and Executive Director James Bell to talk about the closure of the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Currently, there are between 1,000 and I think about 1,300 young people, and they are supposed to be those children with serious emotional problems or such serious offenses that being brought back to the camps and ranches of the local counties is not considered to be a viable option for them. And their days are 23 hours in, depending upon the facility. Their days...
Wait, so they're locked up 23 hours a day?
Some portion of those young people are definitely locked up 23 hours a day. Others are in dormitory settings. They are separated in a variety of categories that I believe enhance violence, north south, blue red, those kinds of categories.
So just like San Quentin, for example.
Absolutely. And if you were to go, you wouldn't really see a huge difference in terms of what about their youthfulness makes these places different. And so the one thing that you can say is they will be in, for those young people that have serious mental health issues, they will be in a continuous program for a significant period of time. So there is a consistency there. But that's about, I think, all that you can say about it. And no one that believes that it should exist in its current fashion thinks that it should exist because it's so great. They're just concerned about what the option is for bringing these young people back home. So even the proponents of DJJ are not saying, well, we're a proponent because you're really destroying a great program. They're just saying
we don't know what else to do.
So let's, and this way we know that those communities are safe.
So hypothetically, say you were in charge of the DJJ, the Department of Juvenile Justice. What would you do?
I would start to realign and try to figure out a way to have the same kind of programming in communities close to home. So I would look
And realignment is what we're doing with the adult prison system, which is, sending most offenders back to the local level.
You could call it devolution. You can call it from far away back to back home. I mean, however you want to phrase it, you could do that. But I would do it very systematically. So I would want to get a demographic profile of all the young people that are there. Which counties are sending us the most young people? And what is it that these young people present with that we need to deal with?
And the Department of Juvenile Justice has shrunk quite a lot in the last few years.
From
10,000 in 1997 to about 1,000 now. And then
built for about 6,000, running at 10, so tremendously overcrowded back in those days.
Yeah, and extremely criticized.
Correct.
What were the big criticisms?
The criticisms were that there was no treatment or services. It basically was
school for gladiators.
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole point of the juvenile justice system is to make sure that we do some habilitation and some rehabilitation so that you won't go on to be an adult chronic offender. And that means that you're supposed to be there to be getting needs addressed that you've expressed as a juvenile. And so as a young person. And so essentially this was a place where it was guards in a pod, hundreds of young people in dorms. And if anything happened, the guards would throw tear gas left, throw tear gas right, and call for backup or the SWAT team. And so you would have to declare a gang affiliation to be protected. It was just horrible. There was really no real interactive model between the young people and the people that were supposed to be serving them. And so it just became custody and control. And as we know, there were beatings, there were deaths, there were absurd instances where kids with special education needs were supposed to get education, but the facilities people thought they were too dangerous. So your classroom was this cage that was, it was like supposed to be a classroom. Literally, you can imagine the absurdity that has to happen when you are non-interactive and you go to custody and control. And so that's what it was.
And you're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with James Bell. He's the founder and executive director of the W. Haywood Burns Institute, which works to ensure fairness in the juvenile justice system. And so now, James, the call is to shut down the Division of Juvenile Justice altogether. Why is that happening now, do you think?
There have been calls to shut down these facilities for many, many years.
Yeah.
And the reasons were what we just talked about. Treatment wasn't right. It was extremely expensive for that kind of treatment. Recidivism rates were crazy in the 60 and 70% range. And so it was like, why are we doing this? But those arguments had no salience because fear, the way politicians frame public safety, it just got no traction. Literally, because of the state's fiscal crisis, is the reason that folk are looking at why shouldn't we do something differently? Now, in fairness, the populations were going down. And I believe that's because locally, the locales were beginning to see that sending their young people away to the youth authority as it was then wasn't productive, wasn't helpful. And so they began to, there's a movement out there in the youth justice field to look at rational policies to become less anecdotal and more based on data and objective screens and probation violation grids and those kinds of things that resulted in less counties sending young people there anyway. And you could really see a north-south split, Southern California being the ones that are most sending, and Northern California sending least.
Sending fewer people to the CYA.
To the CYA. Uh-huh. And so the CYA is
so that sort of gave it a sense that we don't need this.
That's right. And the CYA was also unaffordable in its current construction. So once it's like, we cannot afford these recidivism rates and this expense at the state level, where the county is bearing very little to no expense, we cannot afford this.
So is there a danger here? A lot of people are advocates of shutting down the Division of Juvenile Justice. Is there, though, a danger that young kids are going to be sent to adult prison?
There's always danger. There's always unintended consequences. And I think it's important for those questions to be in the forefront and for people to keep an eye on what's happening. This is not an all-win-win situation. So you're right. We all know that oftentimes justice policy is determined by local department heads. So whether you, for example, sent young people to the adult system with Proposition 21 or any of those things are a decision made by the head prosecutor in those counties. Mm-hmm. And I believe that if we do bring them home, it is incumbent for people to say We are watching you, prosecutor, to see if you're going to now send our young people into the adult system. And what is the rationale for doing that? Because public safety is not a rationale when you have expense and a recidivism rate like we have in California. It's not working. So this whole notion of tough on crime, it's up to the local people in that community to raise this issue of, well, why are we sending them to the adult court? What are we getting for that? Are we just getting retribution and a pound of flesh? And is that what you're saying is the DA? Well, if we live in the communities these people are coming from, we're not saying that, we're not saying that's what we want. So I do think it advocacy will always be required. We must always be vigilant all the time when it comes to social justice.
That's James Bell. He is executive director and founder of the W. Haywood Burns Institute, and he works to ensure fairness in juvenile justice. So, you know, according to the Violence Policy Center, Alameda County has one of the highest youth homicide rates in the state, second only to Monterey County. What are you seeing being done in places like Oakland to deal with this, you know, kids killing other kids?
Yes. My sense is that in terms of Oakland, I feel that they are hamstrung. There's a new police chief there. This has been a neighborhood that has been had youth homicide at a alarming rate for a while.
You're talking East Oakland.
I'm talking about the city of Oakland, mm-hmm. right? And so my sense is that they are at a quandary about what to do. And I don't think there are any magic bullets or answers, but one thing I do know is that you have to engage the young people that are participating in these acts themselves and their communities in beginning to solve these problems. Unfortunately, Oakland has not been able to get past suppression in order to get to intervention and engagement, because the urge for suppression from the citizens is powerful.
So what do you mean when you say that?
I mean that the theme is suppress. You know, we got the 100 blocks that Mayor Kwan has talked about, and there's this notion of we can't intervene until we get it under control, meaning suppress the crime, do what it takes for suppression.
Well, and when you talk to people living in those neighborhoods, that's a lot. That's sometimes what they're saying.
Who
too.
Wants to be in an unsafe
absolutely.
Neighborhood is absolutely true. But what I'm saying is that the two have to live together. You can't suppress, you can't arrest, you can't public service announcement your way out of these kinds of issues that have violence at these rates. You have to intervene and engage people who are a part of this issue.
But isn't that what Measure Y has done with the ceasefire project and with putting these outreach workers on the street at midnight? Isn't that what they're trying to do?
That's a start, absolutely. But clearly, it needs much more scale.
And what do you think does work in terms of violence prevention? And can you point to some concrete examples?
I think it's very hard. But when it's framed as violence prevention, as opposed to neighborhood well-being, then I think we have set ourselves up to fail. Because violence is a byproduct of hurt people hurting people. And so what we need to do is, in a real way, invest in those communities. And actually, those are the communities that are first cut. Those are the communities. And so you can't prevent violence in the context of a larger deprivation of neighborhoods and societies, which they can see. And so to me, you have to engage that. So that's right. Take those 8 blocks, take those 10 blocks, and get people what they need in terms of services. That, I believe, is the best violence prevention. Hard to do, takes courage, and it takes investment.
That's James Bell, executive director and founder of the W. Haywood Burns Institute. He spoke with KALW's Holly Kernan. What do you think should be done to change our youth prison system? How do you think the closure of the Division of Juvenile Justice will impact your neighborhood? Let us know on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hanna Baba, Sarah Bernard, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Carolina Hidalgo, Chris Hoff, Artem Konohovs, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Lisa Ratner, Stephen Short, and Antoinette Sue. Today's show is engineered by Seth Samuel. Holly Kernan is our news director. Cross Currents theme music is provided by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. Also, thanks to City Carshare, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Carshare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. Tune in to Cross Currents Monday at 5. We'll hear a case of wrongful conviction.
It was a shock. It was a complete shock. I felt like, oh, y'all tripping. Y'all making a mistake. You know what I'm saying? You really don't know your job if you're trying to accuse me of murder. You're not doing your job. This is what they said. You had a right to remain silent. You was under arrest. That's what they say.
That's Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. The song you're hearing is by Dana Carmel. Carmel realized while studying psychology at NYU that her true calling was music, and she's been dedicated to its study and performance ever since. Carmel is the opening act this Sunday, February 12th, at the Brainwash Cafe in San Francisco. Music starts about 6 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.